criticisms they throw his way, China is not fazed or threatened. China's economic recovery from numerous challenges, including COVID, came much earlier than many big global economies. And so the best market for China's goods has now become China itself. As Borrell said, the EU is reliant on Chinese goods and services and not the other way around. This is the reason why the EU, despite warning China not to trade with Russia amid EU sanctions, hasn't been able to take any decisive action against the Asian superpower. The US has also tried to undermine China through meddling in Taiwan's affairs. In fact, US President Joe Biden has made his most explicit statement so far on the issue by outright stating that US forces would defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. He was even asked to clarify if he meant whether American men and women, unlike in Ukraine, would defend the island, to which he replied, yes. Despite all the attempts made by US or the EU to undermine China, as Borrell stated, the EU can certainly look for domesticizing production and decreasing its reliance on China, but as it stands, the idea seems more like a distant dream than anything resembling an actual short-term applicable plan to get Europe out of the crisis it's in.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has said Americans don't have a right to freedom from religion. The former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence made the remark on Fox Business Channel on Wednesday, 26th of October. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website, salon.com, has more on this story for us. Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence claimed during a Wednesday, 26th of October, appearance on Fox Business Channel that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution does not protect Americans from having other people's faith forced upon them. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for the redress of grievances, it states. In fact, there are no references to a supreme being anywhere in the U.S. Constitution because the Founding Fathers were adamantly opposed to centralized religious power as well as requiring individuals to subscribe to any particular denomination. The concept of separation of church and state was sacrosanct to men like President Thomas Jefferson, who wrote in his 1776 Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom that setting up their own opinions and modes of thinking as the only true and infallible, and as such endeavoring to impose them on others, hath established and maintained false religions over the greatest part of the world and through all time, and that to compel a man to furnish contributions to money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Thomas Jefferson's condemnation of false faith in the document was unambiguous, further affirming that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burthened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. The website of NBC News has more for us on the same story. Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said on Wednesday, 26th of October, on Fox Business Channel that the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution doesn't provide freedom from religion, the idea that people shouldn't have other people's religious beliefs forced on them. Host Larry Kudlow told Mike Pence that far-right progressives will not allow God into the conversation, will not allow religion into the conversation. Not just the conversation, the schools, the communities, the workplace. I mean, no one is allowed to talk about the Ten Commandments or the importance of moral values. People are allowed to talk about the Ten Commandments and morality in the United States. How can we have a truly great nation? These lefties want to scrap religion, Mike Pence, and I think it's a terrible mistake, host Larry Kudlow said. Mike Pence waited a bit and then responded by saying, well, the radical left believes that the freedom of religion is the freedom from religion, but it's nothing the American founders ever thought of or generations of American fought to defend. The good news is that after 4 years of the Trump-Pence administration, I'm confident that we have a pro-religious freedom majority on the Supreme Court of the United States. Despite Mike Pence's insistence, the First Amendment comes with two parts. He and Kudlow appear to be familiar with the Free Exercise Clause, which says Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. But there's also the Establishment Clause, which says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. In other words, the First Amendment gives people both freedom of and freedom from religion. America's founding fathers were opposed to the government forcing religion on people, especially considering the religious oppression and wars that have plagued Europe in the centuries leading up to the writing of the U.S. Constitution. No man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burthened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities, Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Constitution of Virginia, showing that freedom from religion was definitely something that the Founding Fathers were thinking of. Mike Pence's views on the establishment of a national religion could be of national importance in a few years' time. He has suggested that he's considering a 2024 presidential run, and as he noted in the interview with Larry Kudlow, the president can appoint judges who can rule against freedom from religion.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market.
Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas.
We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical combinations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites, or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay, but all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And, whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore? Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump. And if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that today we're taking a look to see what those effects are, we're looking at the fish, we're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and an understanding of what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine-clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Main Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer and explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedore Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at in the Bedore Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the international platform for munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bedore Lakes. Terry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bedore Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bedore Lakes, but they haven't denied it either. And for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas.
Well,
Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. One million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons. And many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea.
Ensure that the convention's objects and purposes to exclude completely the possibility of the use of chemical weapons is fulfilled.
Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Recalling the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the former Soviet Union, in response to the U.S. missile deployment in Turkey, deployed its nuclear missiles in Cuba and forced the U.S. to retreat from its threats, Russian officials warned the United States and NATO that the continuation of their military aid to Ukraine and the continuation of their threats and sanctions against Moscow will only prolong the war and would lead to a global catastrophe. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia's TASS news agency writes, Chairman of the Russian Historical Society and Foreign Intelligence Service Director Sergei Naryshkin said on Monday, 24th of October, that U.S. elites continue to believe that they can pursue aggression against Russia as long as they want. This short-sighted conviction is teeming with utterly dangerous consequences. Sergei Naryshkin said, at the opening of the historical documentary exhibition, he said, the Cuban Missile Crisis 60 years later at the Central Armed Forces Museum. Today, American elites continue to believe that they can wage aggression against our country for as long as they want, throwing the lives of thousands and thousands of Ukrainian citizens and mercenaries into the bonfire of hostilities. Such short-sighted conviction is awash with utterly dangerous consequences. Naryshkin pointed out the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis and many of the documents on display at this remarkable exhibition also warn of this. Sergei Naryshkin noted that exactly 60 years ago, right during the days of October, the world was one step away from a full-scale nuclear conflict. He said, I recall that by 1962, the United States had deployed missiles with nuclear warheads on Turkish territory, which, of course, posed the threat of a potential conflict with our country. In turn, the Soviet Union, seeking to reliably secure the friendly people of Cuba from the aggressive plans of the United States, placed its missiles in the island. He added, for Washington, it is one thing to surround Soviet territory with its military bases, and quite another thing to suddenly discover Soviet missiles near the U.S. coastline. The reaction of American politicians who had long convinced themselves of this exceptionalism was painful, nerve-wracking, and harsh. It was only under pressure from the compelling circumstances that the White House was forced to admit that there could only be one peaceful way of resolving the crisis, and that was the urgent and mutual recognition of red lines. Sergei Naryshkin highlighted the role played by Soviet envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Dobrynin, and Soviet foreign intelligence resident in Washington, Alexander Feklisov, in defending the position of the former USSR and seeking compromise. The Foreign Intelligence Service Director, Sergei Naryshkin, said, a compromise was reached. Washington and Moscow removed their missiles from Turkey and Cuba, respectively. The world breathed a deep sigh of relief. The chairman of the Russian Historical Society stressed that today many experts and political scientists are trying to compare the current situation in the world with the disturbing events of 60 years ago, he said. And look, in December of last year and January of this year, neither the US leadership nor NATO's leaders, in response to the quite natural proposals of the Russian side, were able to actually reaffirm their commitment to the fundamental principle of international law, equal and indivisible security. The British newspaper The Independent has more for us. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that any direct clash of NATO troops with Russian forces would lead to a global catastrophe after a war of words escalated between Moscow and the US-led military alliance. Vladimir Putin said at a news conference in the Kazakh capital of Astana recently, in any case, direct clash of NATO troops with the Russian army is a very dangerous move, which could lead to a global catastrophe. I hope that those who are saying this are smart enough not to take such a step. President Vladimir Putin made the warning a day after NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Russia would be crossing a very important line if it were to order the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. The war in Ukraine began after Vladimir Putin launched a special operation in February of this year to demilitarize two eastern Ukrainian regions amid Kiev's bid to join NATO, which Moscow deems as its red line. Before sending its armed forces into Ukraine, Moscow had been demanding legally binding guarantees that Ukraine would never be admitted into NATO. The United States and the European Union have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Moscow since the onset of the Russian operation. The Western states have also been accommodating Ukraine generously with advanced weapons, in a move that Moscow says would only draw out the conflict. Another Russian security official has reiterated that the conflict in Ukraine could escalate into the Third World War if Kiev's request for joining the NATO military alliance is accepted. Alexander Venediktov, the deputy secretary of Russia's Security Council, warned about escalation of a nuclear conflict, which, according to him, will affect absolutely the entire world, not only Russia and the collective West, but every country on this planet. Alexander Venediktov added, "The consequences would be disastrous for all of mankind." Sputnik Radio also covers the same story. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said recently U.S. intentions to strengthen the position of Kiev will only lead to the destruction of Ukraine. The Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, said the U.S. is supplying weapons to destroy the country that they have taken care of, that is Ukraine, for many years. This is such a vital contradiction. They seem to want to strengthen and strengthen, but everything leads to the opposite result. Washington's position, which relies on inflating the conflict, leads to the destruction of Ukraine. Maria Zakharova further noted that many in Ukraine already understand this, adding that the U.S. did not plan any peace, prosperity or democracy on the territory of Ukraine. Zakharova said, "They intended to use the conflict as a springboard, as a training ground, as a tool." The statement comes in response to remarks made by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Karen Donfield, during a recent briefing. Karen Donfield said, "Washington intends to provide Ukraine with a maximally strong position by the time peace talks with Russia begin." Karen Donfield added, "We will continue to assist the people of Ukraine and provide them with support to help them defend themselves and their territory against Russia's military operation. We will do this for as long as it takes." Also, in a recent video address to the plenary session of a forum, Maria Zakharova said, "The West's sectoral and individual sanctions on Russia have resulted in a total collapse of bilateral relations with the United States and the European countries." Maria Zakharova said, "The sectoral and personal sanctions have triggered a total collapse of bilateral relations with the United States and many European states. The commercial, economic and investment ties were not blocked by us, but by the other side." The Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman added, "A mass exodus of companies from the Russian market for political reasons fabricated by the West was orchestrated, and sectoral, scientific, educational and sports cooperation, along with development of broader cooperation, was scrapped."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. The faith of some Muslims is such that in order to keep it safe, they should never open a newspaper, they should never read a book, they should never open their eyes, they should never speak to anyone, they should never leave their home, they should never go outside. Such faith cannot last. The faith that is needed is a faith chosen based on awareness. This is a faith that will endure even in the most difficult and dire of circumstances, barring someone who is compelled whilst his heart is at rest in faith. The Quran, Surah 16, verse 106, which was revealed about the Prophet's companion, Ammar Yasir. The Quran says that if you are being tortured, and in order that the enemy leave you alone, you tell them what they want to hear. Your faith is not a faith that can be diverted from its proper direction by persecution. The faith of Khabbab ibn Arat, when they pointed red-hot irons at his throat, is no joke. When they brought those hot irons close to his body and touched them against his skin, his faith was so deep and so strong that even this burning iron couldn't make him surrender it. This faith is based on understanding, based on comprehension, based on thought, based on correct calculations. When we have this faith, it is not necessary to put this faith under a cover or lock it away to keep it safe from the trials and travails of this world, because nothing can harm it in the first place. It is only these unthinking kinds of faith that some people have with which we need to concern ourselves. Unless this happens, or unless that happens, or unless something else happens.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If we want faith to stand firm, if we want faith not to vanish, and if we want faith to be based on understanding, then we must give knowledge to those people whom we want to be believers. We should not feel threatened by them learning. We should not deprive them of the enjoyment of gaining knowledge. Instead, we must make sure that the right knowledge is available for their hearts and minds, so that on the basis of this knowledge, they can nurture a true and strong belief, so that they will have a concrete foundation for their faith, so that their faith won't vanish when someone takes a shot at it. Islam says that faith must come from understanding. It is precisely this kind of faith that these verses at the end of Surah Ali Imran are describing. Indeed, in the creation of the heavens and the earth and the alternation of night and day, there are signs. The Quran, Surah 3, verse 190.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The elegant streets of historic Sevastopol. Ukraine and NATO still claim this city and the rest of Crimea as part of Ukraine, despite the 2014 referendum on joining Russia. Down by the harbour, I wanted to know how people feel about Ukrainian threats of taking back this city.
Crimea is not baggage to transfer in and out. People don't want to return to Ukraine, and they never identified as Ukrainian.
I don't want Crimea to return to Ukraine. We are Russian. We speak Russian. We were raised as Russian, and we have Russian culture. I was born in 1986, and never in my life did I feel myself Ukrainian. I have Ukrainian citizenship, but all my life I considered myself Russian and living in a Russian city.
My personal opinion was Crimea was Russian and remains Russia. I'm an ordinary man, and this is my opinion. It will be bad if someone wants to take away Crimea. But I'm against the war that is going on. It's terrible what is going on in my beloved Russia.
A Russian fighter jet flies overhead, a common occurrence, perhaps returning from a combat mission in Kherson. Sometimes cruise missiles can be seen from the harbour, fired by Russia's Black Sea Fleet, which is based in the city.
Let them dream. It's not harmful to dream. We are at home. Nobody asked our opinion when Crimea became part of Ukraine. We were forced to become Ukrainian citizens. 30 years later, we returned home. We were tormented and were worried. Ukrainians were treating us badly. Everyone here is Russian.
Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Many see that as a historic mistake, not reflective of the wishes of locals.
Now, I have found a couple of people who are more pro-Ukrainian. They don't want to say their views openly, and they do tend to be from a younger demographic born after the fall of the Soviet Union. But even amongst that age group, they are very much in the minority.
So Ukraine and NATO say that they want to take back Crimea from Russia. How do you feel about that?
I wish you good luck. Let's try. They can try, but they won't at all. It's a Russian place. What can I say more?
So we are Russians.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to claim this city as their own, one thing is not in doubt. The vast majority of people living here want to be part of the Russian Federation. Zhenimel, Sevastopol, Crimea.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has been under pressure for his hardline policy against North Korea, as tensions increase amid renewed large-scale military exercises with the U.S. This week, he sought to reassure the National Assembly and the public.
We will strengthen deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities through combined defense posture between South Korea and the U.S. and the trilateral security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S. and Japan, so that our people can continue their daily lives without worry.
Progressive civil society worries the Korean Peninsula has fallen into crisis, with unification becoming more and more remote. They oppose the military exercises, demanding an end to the drills and a rethinking of South Korea's alliance with the United States.
From the 31st, the South Korean and U.S. forces will conduct the largest ever joint air war exercise in Korea, with 250 Air Force units deployed to strike hundreds of strategic bases in North Korea at the same time. The Korean Peninsula should not be an outpost for American hegemony in the world. This land should not be an American war base.
The U.S.-South Korea drills have continued since the end of August, following North Korea's testing of dozens of ballistic missiles. South Korea this week staged a large-scale amphibious landing drill. North Korea views such military exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has emphasized the need for the U.S. to show a strong commitment toward extended deterrence, the so-called nuclear umbrella. But that may not be enough, with stronger conservative voices here calling for South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized a U.S. brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. The Hezbollah leader said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in his statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Many millions of people living across the 27-nation EU are struggling to survive. Brussels resident Jefferson Araujo has endured two rent increases since March. His landlord says her mortgage is going up and so a further rent hike is needed.
You go to the market, you cannot buy anything anymore because the price is too high. And I'm thinking maybe to leave Brussels because I'm working in a hotel 10 hours a day. Like sometimes I have just one day off a week.
In an attempt to bring down soaring inflation, the European Central Bank, which manages the euro, has announced interest rates are going up by a further 75 basis points. That represents a huge increase for people repaying home loans. The economic outlook could get even worse, the ECB warns.
Confidence could deteriorate further, and supply-side constraints could worsen again. Energy and food costs could also remain persistently higher than expected.
Some EU leaders have warned the ECB that increasing interest rates so aggressively could push the eurozone into a deep recession. Higher rates impede business expansion and employment. Charities fighting social injustice often point out all of those taking the decisions that lead to higher inflation and interest rates are insulated from the impact simply because they are the richest individuals in society. Critics say the EU's move to cut out Russia's cheap gas over the war in Ukraine is backfiring. Despite this, a ninth round of sanctions against Moscow is being prepared.
The Commission and the EES are obviously constantly working in the context of the sanctions on making sure that we are ready should there be a need for further sanctions.
Peace seems to be a dirty word in Western capitals.